So I think today is lecture 12 of the StatMet Core course. So David's been talking to you about various methods for studying phase transitions, but today we're going to talk specifically about some numerical methods, specifically Monte Carlo methods that we can use. So to write that explicitly. So we want to specifically study phenomena and like things like phase transitions in systems that are fundamentally interacting. So I'll write that down and then I'll say a bit about what that means. Okay, so we specifically want to study interesting phenomena in interacting systems. And what I mean by that really is systems where we can't come up with any kind of effective single particle theory. So we really need to treat these interactions on many different length scales. And we're going to see today how numerical methods can help us to do that. Okay. So I just want to start by just reviewing a few things from earlier lectures that you would have seen, just that we're going to need today. So, oh, and I should say, I posted my notes, I emailed them to you guys just about 15 minutes ago. So if you prefer not to take notes, you can follow along with those. So one thing you'll recall we saw is that if we want to calculate an expectation value of some quantity, I guess this is from StatMech and also from your quantum theory course. We're going to calculate, this is what we're going to use to calculate an expectation value. And then specifically, we're going to focus on the canonical ensemble. And in this case, we have a specific form for our density matrix. And so what this means is that our expectation value of some quantity is just given in terms of our Hamiltonian like this. Just to remind you, beta is equal to 1 over kBT, so it's like an inverse temperature. As I think you've been doing already, we are just going to set this constant equal to 1. And just another thing is that z is this normalization factor. This is our partition function. Okay. And actually, today, we're only going to look at classical systems. So in this case, instead of thinking about density matrices, we can just think about probability distributions. Okay, and just to be clear about what these sums mean, mu is some state, so we're just summing over all states of the system. And then in this case, I don't need to worry about my full Hamiltonian. I only need to worry about these energy eigenvalues. My Hamiltonian will be diagonal. So okay. So this is probably things you've more or less seen before, but these are just expressions that we're going to be needing throughout the day today. Okay, so what we want to do, why do we care about these expectation values? It's because we're ultimately going to be using some of these expectation values to study phase transitions and try to predict where they are in systems where we can't solve them analytically. And specifically, when we're studying things like phase transitions, we really want to study how our systems behave in the thermodynamic limit. But what we're going to do in these lectures is we're going to talk about how we can get information about the thermodynamic limit, so the limit where we have an infinite number of interacting particles, by studying finite systems. So what we want to do is study finite systems of different size and then look at the trend of these behaviors as we increase the size. So for example, just to make this like really concrete, one of the expectation values we want to study today is the energy. So I just want to explicitly write that down, just so we have it. So the first thing we're going to do is specifically consider ways of estimating the expectation value of the energy for a different system. Okay. So this is something we want to evaluate, but to do this, we have to know what kind of a model we're talking about. So let's talk about this for a specific model. So let's look at the model that we always look at first, which is an icing model. So we'll specifically consider a nearest neighbor icing model, which I think you guys have seen a few times before already. So specifically, we're going to look at a nearest neighbor icing model on a d-dimensional cubic lattice with a linear length L. So this is the system we're going to focus on most of today's lecture and tomorrow, and also tomorrow during tutorial. You guys are going to look at some methods for studying a two-dimensional icing model. Okay, so I'll just draw a picture of this in 2D, but we can think about it more generally as well. So I'm just going to be talking about some lattice in this case of interacting spins. And since I'm in d dimensions, the number of spins I'm going to have is just going to be scale with L to, as L to the power of d. And on each site, I have a variable that's going to be either plus one or minus one, so up or down. Okay, and the Hamiltonian that I have for this system is just given by this. I think you guys have seen this before, right? You've seen this Hamiltonian before? Yeah, okay. So when I write this, I just mean there's a sum over nearest neighbors. And here I'm talking about an external field. And J is some coupling. Okay. Maybe I'll just write that down to make sure. So I'm only in this very simple model. All I'm doing is I'm considering how some site I, I'm only summing interactions with its nearest neighbors, so in two dimensions over those four for that one spin. J is some kind of a coupling strength, we can call it. And H is an external field. So this is a pretty simple model. And in fact, in some dimensions, we completely know how to solve it. So so we don't need to use anything like Monte Carlo methods in these situations, because we can just solve the system analytically. So you guys looked at this in tutorial 2, I think, in one dimension. And then there's a solution by Onsager for d equals 2. Okay. But in higher dimensions, we still have to try to think about how we might solve these kinds of systems. So let's first think. The total number of states that I'm going to have in this type of system this is going to go as 2 to the n, because on every lattice site, a spin can take two possible values. It can be plus 1 or minus 1. And I have n of those states. So specifically in d dimensions, I have 2 to the power of l to the d. This is the number of states. OK, so the most naive thing that we might think about doing is just directly evaluating these sums here. So actually, this is something that at last year's winter school, one of the groups tried doing as the start of their project. They tried to see how fast they could evaluate these sums directly. And I asked them, and they told me that for n equals 25, the fastest they could do was about 1 minute. So oops. By hand?
The one on the right.
The one on the middle.
Little to
by my hand?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, we'll just leave it at that. Well, let's see. Maybe I can just bring, I'll just bring this one down. Maybe? Yeah. Has that happened before?
No.
No? Oh, okay. It's just me. Okay. Okay. So, in any case, I mean, maybe we can make this a little bit better. Maybe this estimate isn't perfect, but I mean, let's just take this estimate to be true and let's, no matter what we have, if we want to evaluate those sums directly, it's going to scale exponentially of how long it's going to take. So if we're wanting to do a sum over 25 spins, as I said, like maybe you can do this in about a minute. But this is going to scale very badly. And so actually, if you go all the way up to, say, 50 spins, it'll take you about 60 years to evaluate those sums in computational time. That's actually still okay. I mean, we can easily do that on supercomputers by putting things on many different nodes, running them at the same time. This is feasible. But if we go up to, say, 80 spins, it's going to take longer than the age of the universe to evaluate this whole sum if you just do it naively. I mean, we can put in count some symmetries and things like that, and we can make this a little bit better, but it's still going to scale exponentially. Okay. So what does this mean? Remember that n is my total number of spins. So if I even just think about two dimensions where I actually already know the solution, we're limited to cases of a lattice that's just 7 by 7 or maybe 8 by 8. Okay. So definitely the most naive method of just evaluating this sum by just summing over everything is not going to work. And it's, well, I mean, it can work. We could get a bit of insight by looking at these very small systems, but we want to study systems as big as possible. So we definitely want to look at other methods so that we can try to find a way to study much larger systems. And we're going to see that by using these Monte Carlo methods, we can study systems that have linear size of hundreds or thousands of spins in two dimensions. Okay, so let's try this again. Okay. Does anyone have any questions so far? Okay, so what I've talked to you about so far is not Monte Carlo at all. So that's why I haven't even written, I wrote the word in the reference, but I haven't actually written it anywhere yet. So that's what's coming now. So let's first just, I'm just going to tell you the basic idea of a Monte Carlo simulation. The idea we want to somehow handle this exponential complexity. Of calculating an expectation value, which I'm just going to write it again because the expression, I want it to be really ingrained in your memory. So I'll just write it many times. So if we want to exactly calculate this expectation value, it has an exponential complexity. But we want to handle this exponential complexity by considering, instead of summing over all exponential number of states, we're going to sum over just a smaller number of states. So we want to consider capital M number of states. Remember, when I talk about a state, I'm using the notation mu. And these are somehow going to be selected at random. So we want to somehow select these states in some way from some kind of distribution so that we get a pretty accurate estimate for this expectation value when m is much, much, much less than my exponential number of states. Okay, so let's consider just, again, like a very naive approach to doing this. We'll always start with these most naive approaches and show why they don't work. So one thing I can do is I could just sample my states from a uniform distribution. So I could just choose every state at random. Random in a uniform way, I should say. So I could choose these from the two. So, oh, can you guys read this if I write over here? Is it okay? Yeah. Okay. So we choose each state. Okay. So then we can estimate this expectation value from some quantity that I'll call QM. This is an estimator, we're going to call it. Okay, so basically, a very naive way I could do this is I could just choose these states uniformly and then use like this exact same expression, except instead of summing over all states, I'm just going to sum over the m states that I've chosen. Maybe I'll just raise this a little bit. Or not, never mind. Okay, we're going to leave it, never mind. Can you guys see that here, or do you want me to rewrite it? Okay. 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 So one thing I actually want to do is look at what this estimate would give us in a case that we know the solution to, because then we can compare it with the exact solution. Okay. So we're going to consider specifically the estimator for the energy. I'm going to actually show you some results for that. So we're going to do this for a one-dimensional icing model. As I said before, we already know the solution here. So we're basically just using this to test our methods. We're not trying to gain any new insight about this model. But if we develop our methods here, we'll be able to take them over into more complicated systems that we can't solve exactly. So here we're just considering some one-dimensional chain of spins. And let's specifically consider the case where we don't have any magnetic field. Specifically here, I'm going to do this comparison for a system with open boundary conditions. I'm just noting that because we're going to consider other things later. So you guys saw the solution for this case in tutorial 2. You know that I can calculate my partition function directly. And then this can actually give me my energy estimator. Okay, so this is what I know my answer should be as a function of temperature. So what I want to show you guys is a code that estimates my energy from this expression here for various values of m. And let's see how that would work. So any questions so far? So here I've sent you guys this code. And all this is doing is basically directly evaluating this estimator here. I'm not going to go over the code right now, but I've sent it to you guys. You can look through it. And then some parts we're going to take and modify a little bit for tomorrow's tutorial. So we will have time to examine it in a bit more detail. It's pretty short. The last bit is just plotting our results. And so the first thing I want to show you is if I look at this on a system where the size is just 4. So I have only 4 spins because I'm in one dimension. And I'm going to consider many samples. So the number of samples I'm doing here is way bigger than the number of spins in my system. So this should work pretty well. And what you see if we do this is it definitely works. So when we're on very small systems, any method like this is going to be fine. So the orange curve here is the solution that you saw in tutorial. And the blue points are what I'm estimating from just taking 10,000 uniform random states and then calculating my energy from this expression here. OK, but again, we already know that we can easily do these things using even that direct partition function sum in on sizes like L equals 4. So this isn't very interesting. So let's go up to something like L equals 50. And see what happens. Okay, so this is what we get now for our energy as a function of temperature. So again, the orange curve is the same as before. That's just our known solution. And now we can see that our blue points, they're actually still doing okay at high temperatures, but at low temperatures, this is giving a really horrible estimate for our energy. So what I want to ask you guys now is why you think that is. Does it make sense to you why this estimate is okay at high temperatures, but it fails at low temperatures? Any ideas?
Because of the exponential weighting.
Yeah.
High temperatures, this exponential weighting is less important.
Uh-huh.
And low temperature, only like a low energetic states are important.
Yeah. And then yeah, perfect. That's exactly right. Yeah.
We've been the unlucky in average.
Yeah.
Finding these very low energy.
Yeah, exactly. So at high temperatures, what we expect is that we basically expect that our states are going to be random at high temperatures, right? So if we look at the probability distribution that we expect goes as this Boltzmann distribution in our cases. If we're looking at the limit of very high temperatures, then beta is close to zero. So many of these probability distributions are fairly similar. Many of these probabilities are fairly similar. So choosing states at random it's fine, right? Like we're just choosing everything randomly, and that's a pretty good representation of what we expect we would sample at high temperatures. But at low temperatures, as a couple of you said, we only expect the low energy states to make a significant contribution in these weights, right? So if I'm at low temperatures, then I'm at a high beta. So there's basically an exponential difference in how much I want to weight states for just a very small energy difference. And the probability that I'm going to choose one of those important states at low temperature is very small. So I end up choosing states that are really not representative of all of my distribution. And so this estimator fails horribly in this case. So, but it's cool to see, though, I think that the methods you want to use can also depend on what temperature you're looking at. We're going to see that, too, that depending on whether we want to study things at low temperature or at criticality, the methods we have to develop are a little bit different. This method will in principle work if I make M very large. We saw that if I was on a smaller system, it will work. But as I get bigger, it's going to fail at smaller temperatures. Any questions? No? Okay. So, need that anymore? Okay, so this first example that I showed you for how we might estimate some quantity from just a finite number of samples, non-exponential number of samples, that was just one option. In general, we can estimate this expectation value by sampling from any probability distribution that we want. It doesn't have to be uniform. So thank you. So if it's some distribution that I'm calling W, then the estimator that we want to use to get an estimate for our expectation value I have to somehow now account for the fact that I'm sampling from some distribution. Okay, so this is similar to before, except I have to put in these factors of the inverse probability distribution to account for what I'm sampling from. Okay, so we can see there's an endless number of options for how I could estimate some quantity that I want to look at. I can choose any probability distribution that I want. But now, this leads me into talking about something that's called important sampling. And I should say this is important sampling is something that is going to be a question on your interviews about why we need important sampling. So maybe you want to think about this a little bit. So as we kind of saw in that demonstration, or you might even be able to think about if you just, again, think about our target probability distribution, this Boltzmann probability distribution here, and how certain states are going to occur with much higher weights. We can think that we'd probably like to sample those more highly weighted states more often. Sorry, guys. Okay. So the idea is that it sounds pretty obvious, I think, when you hear it, but maybe it's not obvious how to actually do it. So we want to sample the more important states more frequently. Okay, so in particular, I mean, there's many ways we could do this where it's still sampling the more highly probable states more often, but you might think that maybe the best way to do this, or at least an optimal way to do this, is if we actually sample from the right Boltzmann distribution. So from this Boltzmann distribution, that is actually the probability distribution we expect for our state space. So if we could actually sample like this, then our estimator would actually just work out to be an average over all the quantities that we measure. Okay. So that makes it seem really easy, but the problem is that we can't calculate this distribution directly. Calculating this distribution would require us calculating this partition function z, and we saw that that involves one of these huge exponential sums. So we run into another problem, that it's not so easy to just directly sample this distribution. So we don't know this partition function, so how are we going to do this? And so one approach that we're going to be looking at to do this is Markov chain Monte Carlo. So when you guys hear a Markov chain, what is that? What does that tell you? Does that give you any information? No? Yeah?
The next state only depends on the previous state.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So, if we're at some state, we're gonna move to the next state only based on our current state. We don't care about any of our previous history. So this is introducing another new notation, which is this transition probability. So the idea is that we're going to start in some state, and then only based upon that state and the state we're considering moving to, we'll have some transition probability. And again, this doesn't depend on any of the earlier states that I might have sampled in my chain.
It can be that you don't know z, because z, of course, cancels out from your expression.
Sorry, say again, z.
So it cannot be that you don't know z, because if you look at your expression for qm, then you have w minus 1 in the numerator and in the denominator as well. So
yeah.
It doesn't matter how you normalize your probability distribution. So z simple cancels out.
I'm not saying that in that in that expression, yeah, z doesn't appear here. But in order to do this, the states that I sample have to come from a probability distribution. So I have to have some kind of function that allows me to sample
that
states.
That tells you like a normalization of the distribution.
Yeah.
And you don't need to know that.
Okay, so maybe I shouldn't write it that way. That's not the only problem with that. So maybe that's a poor way to write it. So it's just. I think you need to like. I mean, I'm trying to think. Is there like, if you like numerically want a sample from like this probability distribution. I mean, I know it's true that it's very difficult to do. Maybe the reason I wrote is not right, but let me think about it. But yeah, definitely, I mean, that's basically why we're talking about this kind of sampling is because this z does cancel out. And so there are ways to do it. It's just maybe like the most naive method where you would just, you know, you can't sample from some known, yeah, I guess it's just we need more sophisticated sampling methods, which is what we're talking about here. But you're right, we don't actually need to know Z in the end. Okay. So, okay, one thing to note about these transition probabilities. Is that they also have to be normalized in some way. And we don't want them to have any time dependence is another thing in these methods that we're going to look at. So this set of states that I get, I'm just going to call this my Markov chain. Okay. Any questions? Yeah.
Do you count the probability to stay in the state mu or not?
Yeah, we do. Yeah. Yeah, so actually this is something we're going to see, that in some of the methods we design, there's going to be times when we actually stay in the same state. So two neighboring states might be the same, yeah. In principle, we don't want to do that too often because we kind of want to sample as much of our state space as we can. But obviously sometimes there's going to be situations where one state is just so much more probable. So we definitely are going to be sampling it more often. Okay, let's try these boards again. Do the front one. Okay, so when we're designing these Markov chain processes, we can basically design any kind of process that we want, but it has to satisfy two conditions. So we have a lot of freedom in how to design these algorithms. And in fact, people use a lot of different algorithms in Markov chain Monte Carlo. But all of them are going to have to satisfy first this condition of ergodicity. What this means is that any state that I'm in, if I think about another state, I have to have some way of reaching this second state from my initial state. So in my sampling, if I start in some state mu, I can go through some series of intermediate states. But it has to be possible, so not non-zero probability, or it has to be a non-zero probability, sorry, that I could at some point, after some long amount of time, reach this other state. Okay. The second condition is called detailed balance. So the first condition that we need is that for this, which is actually less strong than detailed balance, is that the rate that I'm transitioning into and out of a state have to be equal. If they weren't equal, then my probability distribution would be changing with time. So the rate that I transition into and out of a state have to be equal. Okay. So so this first sum here is going to be the rate that I transition into some state mu from any other state. And this next term is the rate of transition out of that state. OK. So I think I can raise just this one. And I'll just write on this one. Okay, so one specific way that I can satisfy this condition is called detailed balance. So this is the detailed balance condition. As we've seen, as I've written there, this is more specific than the previous one I've written. But it turns out that if you don't satisfy this, you can run into some issues in your simulation, which I can show you the reference for it in this textbook I was talking about. I don't want to get into it too much. But the important point to take away is that all of the algorithms we design are going to satisfy this quantity here, this equation here. So now if I'm considering the case where I want a sample from this Boltzmann distribution, then what I'm going to find is that what I want is this ratio of transitions to satisfy this expression here. Do you guys have questions? Yeah.
Can you clarify why you require vorticity?
Why we require that? I guess the idea is that if you didn't have that, then you could get stuck in some region of your state space, right? So you wouldn't be there. You could be sampling something which is not at all the portion of it that you want to sample. So we always have to have some way of getting to other places in our distribution. In practice, it might be very unlikely, but it has to be possible somehow. Any other question?
English cats.
Okay. So our transition probabilities are always going to need to satisfy these two constraints, but we still have a lot of freedom in how we're going to design them. So we're going to talk about some specific algorithms. But first, before we do that, I'm just going to introduce some notation that these algorithms are going to use, which is that we're actually going to split up our transition probabilities. So we're actually going to think of it as a product of two different probabilities. The first one we're going to call our selection probability. And the second one we'll call our acceptance probability. So what this really means, the first one is going to be the probability that we're going to suggest some move in our algorithm. So given this state mu, it's the probability that my algorithm is going to suggest moving to a state nu. But I don't actually have to accept that move all the time. Although, as you might imagine, we probably want to design an algorithm where we accept these moves as often as we can. But we'll see that in most of the algorithms, or in many algorithms at least, we don't always accept these moves. All right, that'll be. Thank you. Okay. So, oh yeah, question.
Can you give an example when you wouldn't accept the move?
Yeah, we're gonna see one, like right away. Yeah, you'll see. Yeah, so actually we'll see, the reason is because we have to make sure we satisfy this constraint here, right? So what we're gonna see is that we could propose any move that we want, but it's difficult to propose one where we for sure can accept it and guarantee that it satisfies this constraint. We'll see it though, you'll see it in an example. Any other questions? Okay, so there are algorithms that exist. We can probably talk about them a little bit tomorrow. There are algorithms that exist that are a bit more sophisticated than the ones I'm gonna talk about today. And there are some where you will accept them all the time, accept the moves. But the first thing we're gonna talk about is a single spin flip algorithm, where the state we're gonna generate from a given initial state is only gonna differ by one spin flip on our lattice. And in this case, we'll see that we do have to have rejection along the way. We can't always accept the move. We're specifically going to focus on the Ising model right now. Although some of these algorithms are pretty easily modified for more general models, but we're just going to look at the Ising model for now. So we want to consider what our algorithm is going to do if we already have some state mu m. We're going to propose a new state that only differs from that state at one location. So I can kind of draw what I mean by this. So if I have some part of my state in this configuration, what I will do is if I'm going to consider modifying this site I, it means my algorithm is going to propose this new move. And what this move is just that the spin at location I, so this sigma I variable, is just going to become negative sigma I. I'm just going to flip that one. Thank you. Okay. So what we're specifically going to consider, although, I mean, you could in principle consider other options. We're going to consider the case where we choose this lattice site just at random. Okay, so again, we're still going to consider a few different single spin flip algorithms, or a couple different at least. But in all of them, what we're going to consider for now is that the spin that we choose to flip when we propose a new update is just going to be selected with equal probability. So I'll start in some state mu, I'll choose some state I, and I'll consider flipping it. And the probability that I'll choose a state I is just going to be 1 over n. And by this detailed balance constraint, for such a single spin flip, what I need to have is some restriction now on my acceptance probability. So I'll see that if I do this, I can't accept my moves all the time. We're going to see that. So if I do this kind of selection process, then I have this restriction here on my acceptance probabilities. But I actually still have a little bit of freedom in how I choose those acceptance probabilities. So we're going to look at two different ways of doing this. So my first option that I might see if I look here is just to choose to choose maybe an acceptance probability like this, I can definitely see that if I do this, my factors of this constant that I'm going to choose are going to cancel out, and I'll get this desired quantity if I use that. So we can choose this constant, but we do just have to make sure that our acceptance ratios never exceed one, because they're probabilities. Our acceptance probabilities, sorry. So for any single spin flip, we just have to make sure of that. But again, we want to maximize these acceptance probabilities. So I can actually figure out what the minimum energy difference would be if I'm considering just a single spin flip. Because if I am thinking about a nearest neighbor icing model, I only need to consider my nearest neighbors when I calculate this energy difference. Does anybody know offhand what the, if you think in two dimensions, for example, what your minimum energy difference could be? What the, or the largest, the biggest energy change you could have from a single spin flip, or even what the situation would be like? Does anybody know?
Everyone pointing up and you turning from up to down.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So if I have a case like this where, if I have a case like this, where this neighbor is different from anything else, everything else, and I propose the move where I flip that one, so now they're all aligned. In 2D, the energy difference here would be, the magnitude of that difference would be 8J, where J is your coupling. And in general, it's negative 4J times the dimension of your lattice. So doing this, what you would find is that the best choice for A naught to have your acceptance probabilities as close as possible to one, but never exceeding one, would be this constant here. Okay. So that's just our first option for how we might choose these acceptance probabilities. And this is a completely valid algorithm that you could implement and it will work. And it will not have as many of the problems that we saw in that initial plot that I showed you. Okay. So option number two is to use something called the Metropolis algorithm. You can read a paper about this from 1953. Okay, so before talking about single spin flips, I'm just gonna say what this algorithm says in general. So in general, we don't even have to be thinking about the Boltzmann distribution. We don't have to be thinking about single spin flips. Just any move you want to propose. This paper introduced the acceptance ratio that's given here. So if I now consider the specific case where I'm doing this single spin flip algorithm, where my selection probability is always 1 over n for any of these single spin flips, and I want my distribution to be this Boltzmann distribution, what this tells me is that I will accept moves with different probabilities depending on whether my energy is positive or negative in this case. Okay, so what this algorithm tells me is that if I propose a move, single spin flip move, where my energy is going to increase, then sometimes I will accept that move and sometimes I won't. It's going to depend on this probability here. But if it keeps my energy the same or it lowers my energy, then I'm always going to accept that move. And you can show that this choice of acceptance probability satisfies deep-tailed balance. Okay, so this is the algorithm that we're going to use in tomorrow's tutorial. And tomorrow we're going to talk a little bit about what we can do with it, what we can measure, what we can look into. But first, I'm just going to show you a rough sketch of how much better this choice is than the first option that I showed you in terms of maximizing these probability distributions. So I'm going to show you what my acceptance probabilities will be as a function of the energy difference of my single spin flip move for those two cases. My minimum energy difference, again, is -4 JD, and my maximum is +4 JD. So for my first option, we made sure we chose our normalizing constant so that it was 1 somewhere, which is going to be at this minimum point here. And so my first curve is going to look something like this. So this is that option one. And option two is going to look more like this. So we can see that this acceptance ratio is going to be a lot higher if I use this algorithm. So we definitely want to use this option two metropolis. And again, this has just been focusing on single spin flip algorithms. We're going to talk about other algorithms that don't rely on this, you know, choosing one site at random and flipping it. We can consider other algorithms that update many spins at the same time and are based on a lot of different principles. So, and these ones will have very different acceptance ratios, but all of them have to satisfy detailed balance in the end. Any questions? Okay, so in the last 5 minutes, I just want to take all that we've seen. We basically, through all of this, we've seen that in terms of the algorithms we've seen so far, if we're just focusing on these single spin flips, then this metropolis algorithm is what we want to focus on. So I'm going to write down kind of in more concrete steps what we would need to do to implement this algorithm. And then we'll see actual code for that tomorrow. Okay, so again, we're specifically talking about this metropolis version of the single spin flip algorithm, and we're looking at a d-dimensional icing model for these steps. So within this algorithm, the first thing that we do generate some initial state. So our first state that we'll consider, mu1. You can choose that in any way you want. You can choose it from some uniform distribution. You can choose it to be all up, all down. It doesn't matter. Anything that you want. And we saw that to do an update, the first thing we have to do is choose a site I. So we're going to, with equal probability, just choose some site of the lattice. So the move I'm considering doing is taking the spin at location I and flipping it, so changing it to be the negative of itself. I haven't accepted that move yet, but I'm going to just calculate the energy difference that I would have if I did accept that move. Then, in order to figure out if I'm going to accept this move, I need some kind of a random number. So I'm going to call this lowercase r. So now I saw that if my energy difference is negative, or if I happen to have this, if I choose this random number and it ends up being less than this number that I've written here, this expression here, then I can accept this move. In this case, I'm going to get a new state that's not the same as my initial state. Otherwise, I'm going to reject this move, and the next state that I'm going to have is just going to be the same as my other one. So the next state in my Markov chain is not going to change because I've rejected this move. So this is the case you guys were asking way at the beginning of whether I ever consider transitioning back to the same state. And in this section, I would, yeah. And then the last thing is we just repeat this many times. Okay. So we're out of time, but this is what we're going to start from tomorrow. We're going to look at code to do this, and we're going to see what we can do with this algorithm. Okay, thank you.